Well, I'd like to call the February 20th, 2024 Budget and Finance Commission meeting to order. Welcome everybody that's here today, and I guess we can get started with roll call. Melissa?
Commissioner LeMay? Commissioner LeMay? Commissioner Garland? Here. Commissioner Miller? Here. Chair Mason?
Here.
And excused today will be Vice Chair Carr.
All right, we'll do the Pledge of Allegiance. Doesn't appear like we have a call to audience, so we can go right into the staff liaison report.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, and welcome back. Hope you're feeling better, members of the commission. Just a couple items for you this evening. A couple weeks ago, we had a council meeting, and I know we mentioned it at the last meeting, some of the items that were on the agenda. A particular note, the Push Ridge Golf Course, there was lots of healthy discussion about the future of that course. Town Council voted to keep that course open and did not set a time frame in doing so. I believe that vote was 4-3 in the positive. So that's really the big kind of the big information that came out of the last council meeting. Additionally, there was an item regarding subsidence at the Valley Vista subdivision. There was some information, additional information that was presented there. It was really just informational only, but staff believes that we have identified the cause, the root cause of that subsidence issue, and we're working with homeowners to communicate plans moving forward on how best to deal with that situation. Other than that, you know, we've got a packed agenda for you this evening, so really looking forward to getting into some of the items. I'll say the one item of note that we'll discuss later is the new actuarial reports came out from PSPRS. So looking forward to that discussion. But thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my staff liaison report.
Thank you, Mr. Gephardt. Melissa, could you go ahead and read item number one, please?
Review and approval of the January 16, 2024 regular session meeting minutes.
Are there any questions concerning the minutes? Could I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Do I have a second? Second. Okay, Commissioner LeMay made a motion to approve the minutes. Commissioner Miller, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The agenda item approved is unanimously approved. Go on to item number two, please.
Presentation about the community's effort to create the next 10-year plan known as Oro Valley's Path Forward.
Good evening. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you. All right, let me just move this a little bit down. All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Renee Olvera. I'm a senior planner with the town of Oro Valley, and I'm here to give you the update on the community's effort to creating the 10-year community action plan, Oro Valley's Path Forward. So the first step in this effort was to create and adopt the community engagement plan and use it as a guide to make the plan as accessible, inclusive, and transparent as possible. And by doing this, we have been able to gather 1,170 online contributions as well as 1,736 in-person responses. And these numbers continue to grow as more opportunities to participate become available, especially right now with the big community survey. We also are releasing important topic discussions, and we're having weekly events throughout town. So right now we are in phase one, and this is primarily community outreach. So we want to meet people where they are in the community, wherever that may be, if that is a community-wide event, local business, or even a youth sports practice. This is to raise awareness of the importance of the plan and to also get ideas and have the community update the vision, values, and guiding principles for Oro Valley's future. And at the end of this phase, we will have the foundation of the plan. So it's very important to participate now because this plan will affect different aspects of everyone's quality of life. As we continue to use the community engagement plan to do community outreach in Oro Valley, we have, you can see this map. This is some of the things that we have done. There are multiple ads, articles out there that you can read about us, podcasts, 43 posters. I don't know if any of you guys have seen the big roadway signs. Yeah, those are really fun. And just a lot more out there right now, just trying to engage people and have them give us feedback and find us where they are. All right. The community engagement plan also calls for participation to be easy, fun, meaningful, and we can hit all these goals with the online engagement tools. So along with all the contributions we have gotten already, we are still putting out weekly social media posts on Facebook and Instagram. OroValleysPathForward.com has a plethora of engagement tools, including polls, discussion forums, giveaway games, and now the community-wide survey. Oro Valley's Path Forward has also been out and about in the community. We have participated in 33 events, and these events range from going to Honeybee Trailhead to going to Stacks Book Club, Starbucks, Ironwood High, just a bunch of different places, and we have a lot more events coming up if any of you guys would like to visit us. All right, and so as we continue to gather online and in-person responses to the three main questions, here's what the community has said so far. When asked, what do you like best about Oro Valley? They say, it's friendly, clean, and safe. What do you think Oro Valley should be known for? Beauty, views, outdoor activities, and kindness. What do you think are going to be the biggest challenges in the next 10 years? Managing growth as it relates to traffic, water use, types of housing, and having more retail and restaurants. So please join the conversation. The big community survey is what we're really focusing on right now. It's 10 minutes to impact the next 10 years of Oro Valley. You can find it online, in person, anywhere. Any of the buildings here have a nice big stack of them. But you can also find our new comment cards around town. Like I said, the events keep coming in, and they're all online. So please go on to ovpathforward.com. And yeah. If you also would like to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, that's where you're going to get the instant notifications. So that's always fun. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions anybody has? Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Melissa, could you read item number three, please?
Agenda item number three, presentation and possible discussion to the town's fiscal year 2023-2024 fiscal update through December 2023.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. Pleased to present our mid-year financial update for you this afternoon. So we'll just kind of dive in here. Just as an overview and some reminders here that all amounts are preliminary and subject to change in the presentation. The year-end estimates may not include any adjusting audit entries that are required at year-end. The year-end estimates should not be relied upon as precise predictors of year-end balances. They're obviously fluid and informational and just based upon currently available data at the time. The town's financial performance through the fiscal year is best indicated by comparing budget to actuals. And then overall revenues and expenditures are performing well, as you'll see. So some highlights for you from the report. Halfway through the year, revenues and expenditures are generally performing well compared to budget. We're seeing strong growth in state shared revenue distributions compared to last fiscal year, which was expected and is trending in line with budget. And we budgeted for about a 3% decline in overall sales tax collections, but we're seeing those collections running roughly flat to last fiscal year. And that's primarily due to construction sales tax outperforming our estimates. Diving into the general fund, and I just need to stop here, pause, and state for some of the newer commissioners, we don't present all of our funds with this report. We just select some of the higher level ones. And normally we do about, we'll do the highway fund, the community center fund, the general fund, normally as a standard course of business for our quarterly financial reports. For this one, because it's semi-annual, we do include our utilities as well. So the water utility and stormwater utility, I'll be highlighting those. So, but with that, dive into the general fund here. Here's the chart for the general fund. basically, what you're seeing halfway through the year, revenues are up about 6.5% over the prior year at about $28.7 million. Compared to budget, we're at about 49.9%. Looking at uses, we're also up by about 9.9% over the prior year. And compared to budget, we're at about 48% of budget midway through the year. And we're estimating our ending fund balance to be about $20.4 million, which is $5.2 million, or about 10% higher than the council's 30% reserve policy of budgeted expenditures. So good news there that we're exceeding what our budget is on our ending fund balance. Sure.
David, are you expecting any spending in the second half of the fiscal year that would cause spending to exceed expectations?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Commissioner LeMay, it's a good question. So we do expect, you know, we're trending above kind of what our, what our expectations, well, we're trending above prior year, but we're actually below what our budget shows there. So we're at 30 million. The slide shows 30 million. 62.8 is what our overall budget is. I think we're going to come close to hitting that overall budget. I think we'll be slightly less. I've got some projections that will kind of highlight in a couple slides that will kind of highlight where we forecast our spending to be. So I'll hit on that at that point in time. But we do anticipate elevated compared to last fiscal year. We do anticipate elevated expenditures. Okay, so looking at general fund revenue, kind of diving in deeper there, local sales taxes are about 2% higher than the prior year, or $286,000. They're also 50.4% of budget. State shared revenues are about 22% higher than last year, or a little over $2 million, $2,025,000. They're also 49% of budget. Charges for services are about 9% higher than last year, or $121,000. They are also at 47% of budget. And then licenses and permits are about 38% lower than last fiscal year, $587,000. And that's primarily due to commercial building permit revenue. However, they are 56.5% of budget, reflecting 77 SFR permits issued compared to 119 budgeted for the year. So even though it looks quite a bit lower than last fiscal year, we're still a little bit above budget where we expected to be for licenses and permits. Looking at general fund uses, personnel is up almost 11% compared to last year, or $1.5 million, $1,555,280. However, it's only 44.5% of budget, reflecting vacancy savings, position refills, and the timing of pay periods. Operations and maintenance is up almost 3% from last year, or $188,000. However, it's 48% of budget. And then capital is up 235% over last year, or $383,000. And that's really due to the timing of projects. However, it only represents about 41% of budget. So still some good capacity there through the balance of this fiscal year.
David, a couple questions.
Yes.
On your capital, this is as of, your actuals are December 31st?
Yes.
So on your capital, are you expecting to spend the remainder of the budget upcoming, or are you going to have anything left there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, we do anticipate that we will expend all of our capital monies at this point in time, and you see that in the year-end estimate. It's the same as the budget, so we're not really anticipating any sort of difference there. We anticipate that at the end of the year, we will have spent all of those monies. As of, you know, that was our estimate as of the midpoint of the year.
And then my second question was on the transfers. So it appears, being December 31st, that you've transferred out more than half, right? But you do expect your year end to be at budget. Could you explain to me what the reason is why it's not just around 50%? Like,
sure.
It's more?
Yeah. Chair Mason, Commissioner Garland. So the reason why is the two primary transfers that are reflected out of our general fund go to debt service. And sometimes those debt service payments are actually, they're paid a little bit before, they're due either January 1st, because they're semi-annual, either January 1st or 2nd or December 31, they actually get paid a little bit before. So you'll see that semi-annual payment for debt service is reflected here. That's causing those transfers to be a little bit higher. And then the balance of the transfers is really discretionary. I say discretionary. It's budgeted, and that's going towards capital needs per our financial policy. So that amount that exceeds 30% by policy is supposed to go towards our capital fund, be transferred into our capital fund. So we anticipate, because we did exceed our policy, that full amount will be transferred by year end. So it's really just a timing issue. By year end, we know what our debt service is going to be. And then we know that we did exceed our 30% policy. So that full budgeted capital transfer will be made by year end. So that's why you see there that the year end estimate of transfers reflects the same as the budget. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it just led to another question.
Okay.
So if you're transferring dollars into your capital fund at the end of the year, do you do the budget amount to the capital fund, or do you true up, like either less or more, depending on where your capital costs are?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, that's another good question. So currently our policy, currently our practice is to transfer what's budgeted. That is something that that we've had discussions internally about, that if we are actually above that 30%, because it's a timing issue. When you establish your budget, it's before year end. You don't really know where you're going to end up in fund balance until the auditors come out. Then you kind of have a good sense of where you're going to land as you're preparing for the auditors and making year-end adjustments. So So it is possible. I mean, you're never going to, when you're establishing the budget, that budgeted transfer, it's possible you're kind of flying blind at that point, making some estimates and things. And so as we know, actuals do vary from projected amounts. And so and so the question is, okay, do you true it up? Do you increase your transfers? Move money out of contingency or whatever to increase that transfer line to really get down to that baseline 30% amount. We have not chosen to do that historically. And in fact, we've really only been making these capital transfers the last couple of years. We hadn't really been following policy prior to that. Well, I'll say the last two or three years. Hadn't really been following policy prior to that. So I think that's something that that we will have further discussions on internally to decide really the best approach for that, whether we want to really get down to that 30%, that true 30% amount, or just to leave some excess cushion in there. Or, you know, if the amount was less, we just wouldn't transfer as much if we were beneath that 30% threshold. So we'd always keep 30% in there as kind of that baseline. So hopefully that answers your question. Okay, thank you. Okay, so diving into the highway fund here, here's the chart for the highway fund. What we see here is sources are trending in line with prior year at about 2.2 million versus 2.1 million. Overall, they're up about 4.4%. Looking at uses, they're up 91% over the prior year. Despite this, we're forecasting the overall change in fund balance to be about $96,000 greater than budget, which would leave about $439,000 or $440,000 remaining in the fund at year end. So diving a little bit deeper into the sources of the highway fund, state shared revenues are a little over 2% greater than last year, or $47,000. Through December, they were sitting at 47% of budget. And all other is 83% higher than last year, or $47,000. Compared to budget, that only represents about 6.6%. And that's primarily due to a $1.5 million budgeted transfer that had yet to occur as of December. Turning toward expenditures in the highway fund, personnel is up 7.4%, or about $40,000 compared to last year. However, it only represents about 46% of budget. And operations and maintenance is up almost 42%, or $122,000 compared to last year. Compared to the annual budget, it only represents about 41% through December. Capital is up almost 148% compared to last year, or $1.57 million. That represents about 63% of the annual budget. The primary drivers there are the First Avenue Mill and Overlay project that was completed earlier this fiscal year, and then also there was a La Cañada Drive Tangerine Intersection Mill and Overlay project that was completed as well. So those are kind of the two capital projects that are driving that increase. Okay, looking at the Community Center Fund, sources are up 14.3% over the prior year at about $4.9 million. They sit right at about 50% of our budget. And then uses are down slightly from the prior year at about 2%. Uses are at about 60% of the budget, and through December, we're projecting the ending fund balance to be about $1 million, which is $454,000, or 81% greater than anticipated with the budget. Looking at some of the details on the Community Center Fund revenues, local sales tax is about $65,000 higher than last year, or about 3.7%. However, it only represents about 48% of budget. Contracted operating revenues are $416,000 higher than last year, or about 20%. They are also sitting at about 53%, a little over 53% of budget through December. Town operating revenues are $128,000 higher than last year, or about 27.5%. and they are at about 15.5% of budget. And then we're projecting a favorable budget variance of about $880,000 or 9.1% in the fund, specific to revenues due to strong golf revenue, recreation programs, and sales tax revenue. Looking at community center fund uses, contracted operating expenditures are at 15.7% or $379,000 higher than last year. This represents about a little over 56% of budget and is primarily driven by higher than expected utilities and labor costs. Town operating expenditures are 6.4% or almost $50,000 greater than last year. Compared to budget, they're at 50%, just a little over 50%. And then capital outlay is at $242,000 or almost 25% below last year, and that represents about 41% of budget. Overall, we expect expenses to exceed budget by about $425,000 or 4% due primarily to higher personnel and utilities costs. Okay, looking at the water utility fund, sources are up about $2.4 million or 26% over last year. That represents about 60% of our budget for the fund. And uses are down about $196,000 or almost 2% from last year, and that represents about almost 43% of budget. We budgeted a use of fund balance of $4.45 million in the fund, but now we expect that to be decreased to about $3.5 million, which would leave a fund balance of $8.8 million at year end. Okay, digging into the water fund revenues, we see that water sales are $1.79 million or 23.6% higher than last year. They're also 58% of budget, and that's really due to a drier year through December that we've experienced. And then charges for service collections are $47,000 higher or 3% than last year, and they are at 48% of budget, almost 48% of budget through December. Overall, water fund sources are at $11.57 million, and that's almost 60% of budget. Looking at water fund uses, personnel is about $71,000 more than last year, or 4.4%. However, only 43% of the budget has been consumed through December. And O&M is about $231,000 more than last year, or 5.3%. And like personnel, only about 41% of the budget has been utilized. So we've got some cushion there through the balance of the fiscal year. Capital is $431,000 more than last year, or 242%. However, that represents only 27.2% of the annual budget. So definitely have a higher budget in capital in the water fund than we did last year. And then debt service is $928,000 or 22% less than last year, although almost 91% of the annual budget has been utilized. And that's really just due to the timing of the debt service payments in terms of how much budget has been utilized. And with respect to the actuals being so much less, that's due to some prior debt service that has rolled off that was no longer necessary this fiscal year. Budgeted transfers out will occur later this fiscal year, are in line with last fiscal year, so not really anything to be concerned with there. Overall uses tally about $10.15 million, representing about 42.6% of budget. Last, we'll look at our stormwater utility. Revenues are in line with prior year. They've actually increased by about $42,000 or 5.8%, and that represents about 45% of the annual budget. And expenditures are also in line with prior year, increasing by about $38,000 or 6.6%, and that represents about 34% of the budget. We budgeted a use of fund balance in the stormwater utility of $101,000, but now we estimate that only $75,000 will be consumed, leaving an estimated ending balance of $848,000. Diving deeper into stormwater revenues, charges for services are outpacing the prior year by about $37,000 or 5%. And we're still awaiting word on the grant application there. You see the budget, no revenues or collections related to that grant yet. Overall revenues are expected to outpace budget by about $30,000 at year end. And then looking at stormwater expenditures, personnel is up $43,000 over last year, or about 11%, and that represents about 46% of the budget. O&M is down from last year by about $33,000 or 20%, and that represents about 35% of the budget. And then finally, capital is up about $28,000 from last year, or 122%. However, that was expected. We expected a heavier capital year as the utilization of the budget only sits at about 10% through December. Due to performance midway through the year, expenditures are at 34% of budget. And that concludes my presentation this evening, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Go ahead if you have some questions.
All right, David, on the Water Utility Fund as part of income, you had a transfer in, which was not budgeted. What was that transfer in, and for what purpose?
Sure. Chair Mason, Commissioner Garland. So that transfer in was an unbudgeted transfer, as you mentioned, and it came from our grants fund, and it was ARPA revenues that we're utilizing for a water project.
Okay, so you took the ARPA funds from the grant fund and you moved it in there to cover the costs rather than taking the costs and putting them in the ARPA fund. Is that so that you can report on that federal?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, we thought that was preferable because this is an enterprise fund, and enterprise funds are really designed to be self-supporting, self-sustaining. So it really functions fundamentally different from some of the other funds, special revenue funds, et cetera, that the town has. So we thought that was the preferable treatment. We could have done, transferred expenditures or posted expenditures related to the water utility activity in the grant fund, as you mentioned. But then that makes tracking overall water expenditures a little bit more difficult because you have them in multiple places and multiple funds.
All right, so if the expenditures, then if you go to the expense side, you didn't budget for those expenditures, or did you? Because the transfer wasn't budgeted,
right.
So wouldn't your expenditures be up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, our expenditures, our capital outlay, the capital projects, what we budgeted are what they are. And so the question really is then becomes, do you utilize ARPA money, which was unbudgeted, to pay for a piece or a chunk of those capital outlays, or which are one time, of course, or do you utilize your ongoing water sales, your water billings, to pay for them? So the net effect of all this is that there's additional water sales or water billings that are going to be able to remain in the fund, stay in the fund as fund balance, because they will not be consumed as budgeted for capital purposes. So does that make sense? Okay, thank you.
David, one slide showed that there was zero money received from federal grants. Are federal grants available?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner LeMay, yes, we do have federal grants available. They have been applied for. We do anticipate that we will have a successful application and that they will be awarded. That's why our year-end estimate reflects that it reflects the same amount as the budget. We do anticipate that it will be a successful grant award, and we just hadn't received those monies as of December.
Any other questions? On the personnel, was the impact of the payroll study, was that all in, was that a full year in last fiscal year, so this fiscal year, or was it started maybe halfway?
Yeah, Chair Mason, members of the commission, so the new pay plan and the new pay plan that the town implemented There pretty much is a full fiscal year impact to that. It was implemented officially the pay period that paid second in July, which was the first full pay period in July, essentially, in terms of hours worked. So, we do anticipate that the impact of that will be basically, in effect, be a full year impact, especially when you take into account the accrual that will be necessary to be made at year end, because most of the pay period, most of the time in June for that first pay period that actually pays in July, it'll be for time that was worked in June. So almost all of that entire pay period will be accrued back into the current fiscal year. So.
Was that the reason for the higher personnel costs throughout the funds?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, that's the reason for the higher personnel costs in comparison to actuals. It's also the reason for the lower personnel costs in comparison to budget, generally speaking, throughout the funds. Does that make sense?
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa, could you go on and read agenda item number 4, please?
Agenda item number 4, review and discussion on proposed town financial and budgetary policies.
Does anyone have any questions on the policies before we? Okay.
I think my question was, and I do understand why they're making some of the changes they are for capitalization, but my questions, one, relate to when you buy capital items with federal dollars, does it still meet that requirement? And then the other one was, with all of these items that are below the threshold, how are they managing and tracking those?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Commissioner Garland, so there are, I'm not aware that this change, the proposed change in capitalization thresholds would have any impact with respect to federal monies or awards. We've seen, I've actually done some research, there are other capitalization thresholds that are, some are higher, quite a bit higher, just depending on the size of the organization, really nationally. So I don't think that there's an impact there in terms of federal grants and awards. The second part of your question, with respect to how we would deal with the amounts, the capitalized amounts, or capital assets that now be below the threshold would no longer be capitalized or need to be capitalized moving forward. So there's a couple ways to deal with this. One is certainly to just write off the assets. To the extent that they have any sort of net book value where they haven't been fully depreciated, that would generate a potential loss in the year that they're written off. To me, that's a little bit of an aggressive approach. Another approach would certainly be to just let those assets depreciate over time until they're fully depreciated, in which they would have no net book value, and then you would write them off at that period of time. And I think that's likely the direction that we would go. I don't anticipate that, even if we wrote them off, that it would have a significant or material impact on the town's finances. However, I think just from a conservative, I always try to be conservative, from a conservatism standpoint, I think it kind of makes sense just to let those kind of ride out and depreciate over time. When they're, fully depreciated, then we would write them off at that point in time, and they would have no impact on the town's finances. So it's really just a timing issue, obviously, as to when you would recognize that loss or the expense, the depreciation expense.
So, David, how are you going to track the items that are under the threshold, though? Like laptops, that would be one, unless you buy a very expensive.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, members of the commission, so we have asset tracking software, and one of our senior accountants actually reconciles capital assets on an annual basis at year end, and so it would just be her responsibility to track those and to make sure that they were disposed, written off or disposed of, cleaned up at the appropriate time. So That would just become part of her responsibilities moving forward until all of those assets, none of them remained on the record.
For the CIP projects that are under the $150,000, do you have, are any of those projects still in progress or are they all completed?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, we do have a number of those projects that are in progress. And we have some of those projects even proposed for next fiscal year that would be included in next fiscal year's budget. So so as it relates to that change from 50 to 150 for CIP projects, that likely really technically or truly be implemented until next budget year when we would start the CIP process. Then we would up the threshold and those $50,000 to $150,000 projects that would have been included would no longer be included. They'd be in the budget. They'd be budgeted as capital, certainly, but they would be included as kind of more the operating capital and just not on that separate CIP list that we present to council.
Are you going to show them as expense then versus capitalized?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, yeah, they would still show as a capital expense. They would still be budgeted as capital. They'd be over the $25,000. You know, if that was the, you know, the council's desire, if they approved it, obviously if it was recommended through this body to council for approval, they would still show up as capital items. They just wouldn't be on the CIP list.
And so you wouldn't capitalize them as an asset then, even though they're still budgeted in capital, they wouldn't be treated as capital from an accounting perspective?
Mr. Chair, they would be treated as capital. They would continue to be treated as capital. They just wouldn't be on the CIP list. The CIP list is really kind of a separate list. We have a 10-year schedule of all of our CIP projects. They're meant to be larger projects in scope and scale, have a higher visibility because of the higher dollar threshold and spend to the community. And so, so again, they would continue to be capitalized as long as they met that, you know, whatever, $25,000 as it's proposed, that $25,000 threshold. They'll continue to be capitalized. They just wouldn't qualify for being a CIP, to be on the CIP list.
I would think it'd be the other way around. But so are you not going to start this policy until next fiscal year or budget year? You're not going to start it this current fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, we probably wouldn't start the policy until next fiscal year. Yeah, you know, July 1, and kind of have that clean break. So, you know, it's likely that it'll be, if it's, again, if it's recommended, if there's no issue from this body, if there's no issue from a council perspective with the increase in thresholds there, it's probably going to take a couple months before, and this item is just discussion only, so it's not not being proposed for approval to go before council yet at this point. Just wanted to kind of get your eyes on it, get your input, listen to what the comments and feedback were, implement any sort of changes potentially, or have discussion about proposed changes. So, you know, this is not something that we're necessarily trying to rush into. It's going to be probably several months before council sees this, where they would have the opportunity to formally adopt and approve it, and then, you know, likely, again, probably looking at a July 1 implementation.
Do you have an idea of the value of the all the CIP projects that are under the $150,000 limit?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, that is information that I could get for you. I don't have it in front of me. I could scan through the list, but
that's
would be a disaster.
Is it possible that we can discuss this at our next meeting, too?
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, that was the plan, was that we would have, you know, we'd, again, listen to the feedback, take address hopefully some of the questions. If there are proposed changes, maybe address those, bring it back at a future meeting, probably the next one, so that we can kind of build that momentum. This is all really kind of foundation building for us moving forward.
Are there any other questions on any of the other policies? Did you have a presentation to give?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I don't have a formal presentation for this one, but I certainly could probably spool one up for the next meeting.
No, I just didn't want to take your time away before we start asking questions. One thing on the expenditure policy, I think it's 1.8. I was looking at, you have various transfers and that you can make and what the approval level is. Now you're, for everything but the general fund, you do it by fund. So, but for the general fund, you do it by department. So if you do transfers between departments within the general fund, then that would require mayor and council approval?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, no, I don't believe we've interpreted the policy that way in terms of transfers. I believe we still have the ability to transfer between departments. I believe that's in the authority and purview of town manager. However, a transfer between funds from the general fund from the general fund to another fund or from another fund into the general fund, that would require town council approval.
But because you set your lowest budgetary legal authority at the department level within the general fund, wasn't that the same as setting it at the fund level for all the other funds?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, from a legal budgetary standpoint, I agree with you. I agree with that perspective. However, from a transfer standpoint, it's different. So
I'm talking budget capacity transfer, not expenditures or stuff like that. But if one department was, if you wanted to take, like you did, I guess, in your notes, in your budgetary highlights, you moved budget capacity, if I'm understanding it right, from the general administration department to other departments. Now, by doing that, isn't that the same as if you were to transfer it from one fund to another fund because of the way you have things set up?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I don't view it that way. I understand the viewpoint and the perspective, but I don't believe the policies call for that. I think what you're trying to do is equate, again, the legal budgetary capacity or authority, which is by department, equate that to the other funds, which it's at a fund level, and then say, that basically because it's at a fund level for the other funds and it requires council authorization to move money between funds, and that part of the policy is clear, so there shouldn't be any disagreement with that part of the policy, that then you're making the jump and the leap that, well, because that's the case between funds and it's set at the fund level for those funds, that between departments that there needs to be formal council authorization to move money between departments. And now that's something that could be written into policy. I think that's kind of a gray area. I don't think that there is a clear, it's not clearly written into current policy. So it's not a bad idea. I mean, it's something that, we could have discussion about if that's something, again, if that's a change that that you want to address or have reflected in a future iteration or draft of the policy, that's something that we could have discussion about, but it is not in current policy as it exists.
That was part of my question when I was looking at the expenditures policy. It didn't show that listed, and so that's why I brought it up. But maybe we can discuss it next time as far as the lowest level of legal budgetary authority, because it sounds to me like since you're establishing that at the department level within the fund, you're kind of making it the same level as all the other funds, even though you're establishing at a fund level, but we can talk about that next time.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other? J- Just one more. On the debt, you have a note in the your ACFR, not CAFR, ACFR, about pledged revenue, and you have a percentage there, 14% of total revenues. And I was wondering, would it be helpful from the viewpoint of planning, because you do all of your debt basically pay as you go, is there a percentage there that you wouldn't want it to be? In other words, if it was, you wouldn't want to go to 20% of pledged revenue because it might impact other programs. So would it be helpful to have whatever percent we thought was appropriate to have that kind of as an indicator from a management perspective that says if we're going to issue more debt, but our debt service is going to take us up to 20% of pledged revenues, do we really want to do that, or is there other decisions we want to look at or other options or whatever?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I think that'd be another worthy discussion item to take a look at for a future draft. I have not given that a whole lot of thought at this point in time, but I think certainly there probably ought to be. I think it's a really good idea. I think there probably ought to be an upper limit or threshold that that would protect the town and its finances moving forward, that we didn't become over leveraged from a debt standpoint. So I think that's something I need to noodle on a little bit more.
As another question, in your bond documents, what does it say in there about what revenues you're pledging? Is it total revenue, taxes? I know you have the table in the back that has the what makes up excise tax revenue. So in your documents, what does it stipulate is what revenue you're pledging?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, it is excise taxes, and that is why the statistical section outlines what's included in excise taxes. So it's excise tax, not just sales tax, but there's some other items in there that are included in excise in that excise tax calculation.
So maybe we can discuss that note next time too. Any other questions on policies? Okay. Well, thank you. We'll move on to item number 5, Melissa.
Agenda item number 5, presentation and discussion of PSPRS pension funding.
You're up again.
Well, good afternoon once again, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. I need Wendy back. I feel like I'm doing a lot of talking here. No, it's all good. I was foolish in granting her some time off, but which is great for her, but bad for me. Anyways, as mentioned earlier in the staff liaison comments, the town did receive our actuarial reports from PSPRS, which encompasses both the court plan, the PSPRS plan. The court plan really is for our dispatchers, and really we only have, I think, a couple active members on the court plan. All of our future dispatchers, I believe, are now a part of ASRS moving forward. So that's kind of a closed plan, so to speak. And then we got the PSPRS plan. And just some history here as to, again, kind of foundation building for all of you, because we got some new members, and some of you probably aren't totally familiar with where we've been on this issue from a town standpoint. But we had some pretty significant liabilities accruing over time, and they were accruing rapidly. They were growing at a rapid manner, and so several years ago, we decided as a town, town council, staff, to really address this issue, and we wanted to address it really comprehensively and holistically. And so what that looked like, we brought in a consultant to study the issue and to propose a number of different options. I think they went through between 8 and 10 different scenarios, if I remember right, looking at an all-debt scenario, looking at an all-reserve scenario, looking at a combination thereof, et cetera. What they found was, which was adopted by council, was a scenario that had the lowest cost to the taxpayer was kind of this comprehensive scenario out of all the scenarios that they looked at that included a partial debt issuance, which was about $17.5 million, $17.6 million, a $10 million payment out of reserves, which the town had, and then moving forward, that would kind of bring us up to 100% full funding, so about $27.6 million total contribution, bring us up to 100% funding, and then hopefully just stay up with contributions moving forward, with the intent in changing our policy at the time, our PSPRS pension funding policy, with the intent of hopefully getting up to about 110% funding, at which point, once we reach that kind of that upper limit, that upper threshold, we could dial back contributions, and that would provide budget ongoing budget savings to the town, and really protect the town from any sort of escalations moving forward. So we did that. We implemented that plan. I believe it was in 2022 that actuarial, maybe it was 2021. Anyways, actuarial report came out in 2022. It ended up that we were actually 102% funded in PSPRS. But we didn't dedicate any of that bond issuance, the 17.6 or even the $10 million reserve payment, we didn't dedicate any of it to the corp. So the corp still had this $2 million liability sitting out there, hanging out there. And so with our policy, what we decided was we're going to keep, the policy called for this, we're going to keep paying at least around $2 million, which was roughly the amount that we were paying in an annual fashion to pay down our unfunded actuarial liability and amortize that over time. We're going to pay that towards the corp policy to catch the corp plan up and bring that up to 100% funding. Fast forward to today, this past December when these reports were released, they cover you see the actuarial valuation date, and these reports are included in your packet, June 30th, 2023. So these are the most current reports. We actually received them in late December and pulled them off the PSPRS site. And what you see here, and I'll kind of get into it, but what you see here is back in 2022, we were actually 102% funded, and I believe around 46% funded on the court plan, 102% funded on the police plan. The 2023 valuations, we dropped down to about 95% funding on the police plan, and now over 100% funding on the corp plan. So our strategy from the corp standpoint was definitely effective. It worked. But now we've got this liability on the police plan again that we're going to have to catch up with. So with all of that kind of as the backdrop, I'll kind of get into this brief presentation. Again, kind of foundation building. This is really basic, but it's important for all of you to have an awareness as to what's going on here. So there's two primary outflows out of the pension plan, and one of those outflows is benefits, which is what our employees have earned over their term of working for the town. And then there's some related expenses in terms of the costs of running the plan and administering it. So those are really the two primary outflows. Those have to be counterbalanced by the inflows. And there's only really two primary inflows in the plan. One of those inflows is contributions, either the employee and or the employer. Really, it's a combined contribution factor there, both employee and employer. And then investment income. Because the pension plan does invest these contributions, there is investment income. Sometimes there can be investment losses as well that are sustained. But those are the two primary inflows that are paying for the benefits and the expenses, the outflows of the pension plan. So just again, really kind of high level basic information here, and it's. You know, it's It is simplified. There's a whole lot more going on here than just this, but it's important to have this kind of as your foundation. Okay, so this slide really attempts to kind of give a visual representation of the information in these actuarial reports. Again, really high level and simplified, but important to understand. You have your assets that are at the valuation date, and then you have what's called an actuarial accrued liability that is calculated by the actuaries. And what they're doing, what the actuaries are doing, is they're utilizing a number of different inputs and sources to try to determine what that liability is going to be what that liability is in real time, I should say, based upon all current service up to that point in time. And so, and then you have what's called your present value of future benefits, which is kind of that future, that's really looking out into the future and saying, okay, that's everything that is going to need to necessarily be paid out over the plan for your employees. And so, so you have, again, you have your assets at the valuation date, which is relatively easy to figure out and estimate. And then the actuarial accrued liability, that one's a little bit more difficult, but you know, because there's some factors included in there, like you know, what's the current you know, when you anticipate someone's going to retire, what's the current how far they are into their career, where are they at, how much are they earning, all of that, and then you know the plan, how it determines. What is going to be, you know, if the plan ended today, what would need to be paid out? And then you have the present value, which is really looking into the future and looking at mortality tables and things of that nature and saying, okay, how long, you know, if they retire at 55 and they pass on at 80, well, we've got to cover about 25 years of this person at this pension at this rate to figure out what the future benefits are and what would need to be paid out. So that future value, present value of future benefits, you see here that there's an, you know, kind of that normal cost, and there's an amortization here that's listed on the slide. The normal cost is really intended to cover current employees and be kind of that self-sustaining amount that is due both from the employer and the employee to cover current benefits earned up to that period. You know, and as long as everything is balanced and working the way it ought to, that ought to be enough. But if you have, going back to the prior slide here, if your investment income doesn't keep up and or your benefits for whatever reason need to increase, then that upsets the balance a little bit, and you have to figure out a way to counterbalance that, and the only way you can really do so is through additional contributions. So hopefully that makes sense. Okay, so looking at our chart here, you really see, you know, you can kind of see the assets, which are represented in blue. This goes back to 2009, so a lot of history here. But you see the assets here, and then the liabilities, which are represented in the orange box there, year over year, and you can really see that that the assets have not really kept up with the liabilities. And again, that kind of goes back to my point that this was becoming kind of a pretty significant issue financially from the town. And so we wanted to address it. Go up to 2021, you see, you know, really that growth year over year in the liabilities really outpacing what the asset growth is. So something needed to be done there. And investment income, just in and of itself, you would have to really be lucky for investment income to turn the corner and to make up that kind of difference there. So that's where we kind of said, well, something additional needs to be, and it has to be contributions, so something additional needs to be included there. So 2022, you see, that's where that additional infusion of cash happened. You see that the assets actually went up and increased to such a degree with that additional contribution, both in terms of a pension obligation bond and reserve payment, that it actually exceeded the liability there, which had, our unfunded liability actually dipped down into the negative there. And then 2023, you see the increase there in the orange. Again, it outpaced what our asset growth was, and we're starting to see that unfunded liability creep up again. Here you see the police PSPRS employer contribution rates by year. Again, really good history here to give you a sense of what's been happening. The normal cost rates, kind of that light orange, the total employer rate is represented by the red there in the graph. And what you see there is that significant, the total employer rate, because the amortization of that unfunded liability was becoming so large, that total employer rate was spiking up near 44% back in 2022-2023 because of that infusion of cash where the assets exceeded the projected liability. It actually went down to 11% in 2024. That's the current year that we're in, so our employer rate's at 11% because we didn't have to amortize a liability over time. And then you see it jump up to about, our total employer rate jump up to about 16%, which is included in the most recent actuarial evaluation, because now we've got another liability to start amortizing. And then that normal cost rate, I think it's important to note there, it's stayed really pretty consistent. So it did pop up about 16% in 2018, but it's been slowly decreasing to about that 11% level, and we anticipate that moving forward that it'll stay at that level. Because the important thing to note here, again, just more foundation building, the important thing to note is that we're really talking about the Tier 1 and Tier 2 plan here for PSPRS. Tier 3 is kind of the newer plan that all new employees go into. That Tier 1, Tier 2 is a closed plan. There's not new employees that are adding into that plan. All new police employees automatically get enrolled in Tier 3. Tier 3, the benefits are not nearly as rich. So basically what we're seeing here is that Tier 1 and Tier 2, that closed plan, the normal cost rate should stay pretty level moving forward, because they know who's in that plan, they know exactly where they're at in their career, et cetera. So there really shouldn't be any sort of increase or fluctuation there moving forward. Okay, so let's get into one of the pages. Here you see page 6 in the report. This is kind of there's a lot of important detail and information in this report, honestly, but this one's kind of the big one that kind of shows our actuarial accrued liability there in 2022. It was actually not a liability. It was an actuarial accrued asset of the town of about $1.5 million. That increased from, or decreased, depending on how you look at it, went from $1.5 million from an asset to about a $4.3 million liability in 2023. You look at the funding ratios there. Again, they do funding ratios they have two different calculations there. The one that we really pay attention to is the bottom one, the actuarial accrued liability funded ratio. And that one is looking at the actuarial evaluation of assets over the actuarial accrued liability. So we went from 102% funding to 95% funding. So again, kind of the history here, we paid about $27.6 million on July of 21, as I mentioned earlier. So you kind of see the funding ratio there. Our employer contribution rate's about a little over 16%. That's what the actuarial report shows. You see our present value of assets, about $94.5 million, and then our actuarial accrued liability at 85. Present value of benefits, I should say, about $94.5 million. Our actuarial accrued liability at 85.6. Our assets are at 81.3. Market value asset value of assets at almost $80 million, $79.8. So looking at the unfunded actuarial value of assets, it's that 85.6 less the 81 to get to the $4.3 million. That present value of benefits, again, going back to this slide here, that present value, that's the present value of future benefits. So that's really looking at the whole shooting match as to what would be required over time. But obviously there's going to be ongoing contributions, you know, both employee and employer contributions to mitigate some of that moving forward. Okay, so looking at the investment returns over time, the plan is actually, it's actually been doing pretty well from an investment standpoint. There was a period of time where it wasn't doing really well, but you look here, the important thing is that they are at least exceeding over time what their assumed earnings rate is. And that's, again, one of the primary primary factors that is included in these calculations from the actuary is, okay, how much do we anticipate that these investments are going to yield moving forward? They've been slowly dialing that number back. It used to be several years ago was at 7.5%. A couple years ago, I think last year it dropped down to 7.3. Then they changed it for this actuarial valuation down to 7.2, I believe. So what that means, the impact of that is general standpoint is what they're calculating here, the actuaries, they're looking at this investment income on this equation and saying, okay, over time, we're going to, you know, we anticipate that the plan's going to bring in 7.5%. Well, if you dial that back down to 7.2, you have to make up more income. And the only way you can make up more income is not through additional investment income because they've already calculated and factored that in at 7.5. You have to make it up with additional contributions here. So just from a reality standpoint, whenever they make a change to this assumed earnings rate, there necessarily have to be additional contributions, so it does increase the employer rate into the plan. Now, again, there's a lot I need to probably say here. I'm probably going to miss some things, but bear with me. The way the PSPRS plan works fundamentally is that you have an employee rate and employer rate, and it's a defined benefit plan, which is based upon years of service and average compensation. The employee rate is fixed at 7.65%. So if you do need additional contributions, that means your rate needs to increase, and the only way that that rate increases, it fully is burdened upon the employer, which means it's burdened upon the taxpayer. So the employee never really can't, by Arizona law, can't kick in more additional contributions. They are fixed at 7.65%. Their benefits, if they did kick in, and there have been court cases and rulings regarding this, if they did kick in additional contributions, that's considered a loss in benefit to the employee. And so those cases have always been ruled in favor of the employee, that they cannot contribute any more than 7.65%. It's considered a contractual arrangement, a contractual agreement between the employee and the municipal or the local government. So, any additional contributions means a higher rate, which means that more money has to come out of the pockets of the taxpayers. Again, going back to this chart here, looking at these investment returns, they have not been horrible. You look at 10 years, especially over the long term, 7.2. Looking at the 7 year there, 7.8 versus 7.2. So they actually exceeded what that assumed earnings rate is. 5 years, 7.2 versus 7.2. 3 years, 10.3 versus 7.2. So you definitely had a good year. About 3 years ago, they had historic returns in the plan, I think of about 27.7 6%, if I remember correctly. So you're seeing that that on the on these returns really throughout the entire 10-year period, but especially you notice it in the 3-year. Yes, Mr. Chair.
These rates are they're smooth rates. So that 7.2 is that 7-year or whatever number of years they aggregate them all together. So they smooth it out. So we really won't see the. I just want to make sure everybody understood that that was a smooth rate and not an actual return.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, these are actual returns. Yeah. So the because you can't really smooth a 10-year. The smoothing is done on a 7-year period. So what happens there is, and really what they're trying to do, again, this is just foundation building for you all to kind of hopefully bring you up to speed. What they do on the 7-year smoothing, which you can see, I'll look in the report here. It's represented on page 14 of the report. So you see the smoothing there of the experience. And so the smoothing goes back to 2017. And what they're doing is they're saying, okay, based upon that individual year, the plan either made money or lost money. And if it lost money, well, I mean, both of them, that you see that those kind of get amortized over time. So they really try to smooth this to try to... the purpose here is to avoid any sort of spikes in rate from year to year, depending on the investment returns or losses in the plan. So, but yes, these are actual rates that you see here, and this last year, 7.6%, which you can find in the again, it's in the actuarial report, 7.6% this last year versus 7.2, 10.3. Versus 7.2 over that 3-year period. Now, that 3-year period includes a really good year of about 27% in return, and it includes a really bad year, the year after, of a 4% loss in plan assets. So it was actually a net loss. So, you know, again, that, but it's over the 3-year period, about 10.3%. So the investment returns, I would say, are not the issue here as to why we went from 102% to 95% funding. I don't anticipate that 7.2% assumed earnings rate will go down moving forward. I think it's going to stay constant because if you look, again, over the long term here, over that 10-year time horizon, or even the 7-year or 5-year, they're meeting that benchmark. As long as they're meeting that benchmark, that doesn't cause any problems for the plan. It's only when they don't meet the benchmark that that causes issues because then they think, well, it's too high. It's not realistic. We've set that bar too high. We need to reduce it to get to something a little more more realistic, which means additional contributions. Okay, going back to this, I don't know if I need to review it or not, but basically again, really important chart here to kind of understand. We've got the assets at the valuation date. It's really kind of saying that based upon all of the inputs and whatever, this is what the total assets are. We've got the liability, which includes all the current service earned to date. And then we've got the present value future benefits, which assumes that everybody that's in the plan, it includes all the retirees and et cetera, but everybody that's in the plan that's currently still working, they're going to have pay increases. The calculation here is either it's two things that sets their benefit. It's rate of pay and then also time of service. And so as they continue to earn more service time, and their pay increases, then that is impacting the present value of their future benefits as well as impacting the service earned to date in real time as they move forward. And then there's potentially an amortization that needs to happen if the assets are not adequate to at least meet that actuarial accrued liability. Okay, so... this is all really, hopefully, foundation building for where we're going in the next meeting or future meetings, where we will actually bring the pension PSPRS pension funding policy back to you for a comment. I believe the current policy has been included in your packet, So then the question naturally is, well, Dave, why did you go from 102% funding to 95% funding? What in the world's going on there? So wanted to address that before I address any additional questions. So if we go to page 2 of the actuarial valuation for the PSPRS, they have a nice chart. The actuaries have included a nice chart that takes you from your current contribution rate, which was calculated as of the date of the last actuarial valuation, which was June 30th, 2022, to the contribution rate that's proposed as of June 30th, 2023. And you see there that when you start with an 11% rate on the pension, asset experience adds about 30.31, and please stop me if you can't find where I'm at. Chris, do you think you can, well, let me, if you bear with me just for a second, I can probably bring this up on the monitor if that would be helpful. I apologize for not having this in the presentation. That's me. So do you
yeah, so the 11%, that is my basic question, is when you really
contribute. Yeah, so again, I can bring this up if you give me a few minutes to jump behind the booth. I can pull this report up for you and show you this report. But basically, you have your contribution rate, which is 11%, which is the last valuation. Your asset experience adds about 0.31% to that. And then, they have nice definitions down at the bottom of the chart. So asset experience is your asset gains or losses relative to the assumed earnings rate. So you say, well, Dave, that, you just showed me a chart that said you're meeting your assumed earnings rate. What's happening here is they actually decreased that assumed earnings rate from 7.3 to 7.2, which means that your asset experience needs to necessarily impact your rate. So that's what's happening there. So it adds, going from 7.3 to 7.2 adds about 0.31% to the rate. Here. Liability experience adds another 6.02%. And liability, so this is really the primary driver as to why you're going from 11% to 16.22%. Now, liability experience, again, the definition down at the bottom, experience overall was unfavorable, driven by salary increases that were higher than expected. So a part of the model that the actuaries have to there's a number of assumptions. One of their assumptions is payroll growth. And if payroll growth increases more than what they expect, that has an impact on the liability. And that's exactly what happened. So if you think back this current fiscal year, but even it impacted last year because there were retro pays that were made, et cetera, going back into last year on the police plan. So what happened was we had this new pay plan that was approved, and that is really, really driving this liability experience because the rate of pay, the amounts of pay that it increased for current employees, it doesn't impact anybody that's already retired, obviously, but current employees is impacting the liability because it was greater than what they anticipated. So that's what's driving that. Additional contributions of negative 0.1%. So we didn't really make any additional contributions. I guess maybe a little bit, but it's actually having that. If you make additional contributions, it actually lowers your percentage that's due. And then the actuarial audit of 0.99%. They did an actuarial audit in 2023, really looking at a number of different factors and changes and things, it says the most notable change was prorating the COLA benefit to the first year of retirement. So so that's having an impact there of almost 1%, and then other of minus 2. And the other is a combination of all other factors that could impact liabilities year over year, et cetera. So, I guess the long story short on this is we did, the town did implement a new pay plan that was effective for police employees, and that really is what's driving this increase in the rate moving forward. Now, I mentioned it in my staff report in your packet this evening. What we did as part of our pension funding plan in the current year, so this was approved last year, was that we approved an additional $2.5 million of contributions into the PSPRS plan. So I went back and looked at, again, there's a report in here that's really helpful, and I'll reference the page here for you. Okay, page 8. Page 8 shows the impact of additional contributions, and these amounts, so at the top, there's got kind of a bar chart at the top that shows the additional contributions. If you, and they're all in a million, so if you contribute an additional $1 million, your funded status would be 96.1%. If you contributed an additional $2 million, your funded status would be 97.3%. Again, all else considered equal. If you contributed an additional $3 million, your funded status would be 98.5%. So I was looking at that. I'm like, well, between $2 million and $3 million is $2.5 million. That's what we're contributing additional this year. That was budgeted. We've already contributed half of that amount because we contributed on a quarterly basis. And so, again, all else considered equal, that would bring our funding status up to about 97.9%, or roughly 98% as of the end of this year. So that still wouldn't, that $2.5 million still wouldn't get us up to a full 100% status. To do so, we'd have to contribute, looks like a little over about $4.4 million, somewhere in that ballpark.
So range. Are we going to make that? Are we going to make that additional payment as well?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, so that is not, has not been contemplated. I mean, that is something that that could be.
Is that in our policy now?
I believe as I read the policy, the additional $2.5 million is in the policy, but I don't believe that we need to completely get up to 100% funding by the end of this current fiscal year.
Yeah, I guess we should look at that in our policy, because I think the sentence after that says if we fall below that we make enough contribution to bring it back to 100 now, but we can look at that as well.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, so, and these are all, that's good feedback and good discussion. I believe you will be, again, all else considered equal. But number one, let me say, these are all estimates. And this is kind of shooting in the dark a little bit here, because we don't know what investment returns are going to be at the end of this fiscal year. As we stand today, I believe they're going to be very positive. And I think that's going to, now it's going to be smooth, but it's going to have a positive impact on the total value of assets, because we are so close to that 100% threshold. I believe that we'll get a little bit of a bump from that. But secondly, you know, again, that's why I say all else being considered equal, we'll be at about 98% by the end of this fiscal year, you know, and might be a little bit over that. Candidly, we don't really know, because we don't know where investment yields are going to land. But my sense is that they're going to be, we're going to have another good year. Those investment yields are calculated on a fiscal year basis, so they run from July 1 to June 30th. So I think we're in good shape there. And if we hit that 98% threshold, what would it take for one more year to get us back up to 100? Well, it'd be about another $2 million, roughly. So you know, again, that's kind of that's a rough estimate because we don't know what's going to happen in the future, and that would be predicated upon the investment yields next fiscal year as well, and that smoothing that takes place. So, with that said, that concludes my presentation, and I'll just open it up to any additional questions, comments, direction.
Comment: What I'm seeing is that the city benefits from improved performance of the investments.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner LeMay, absolutely. As long as investment yields are positive, meeting, if not exceeding, that assumed earnings rate, that has a positive impact on future contributions, because then the town does not need to contribute as much.
So the employee does benefit in that their contributions don't have to be increased if performance of the investments goes up as well, correct?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner LeMay, the employee, how do I best say this? The employee really is held harmless. They don't necessarily benefit. They just, I guess they could benefit in that there could be, you know, potentially there could be more resources available for future raises or things of that nature, because then we wouldn't be contributing as much towards PSPRS. So there could be an indirect benefit from that standpoint, but their rate is fixed at 7.65%. So they don't, you know, any sort of increase in investment income really doesn't have an impact to the a direct impact to the employee. It doesn't cause them to have to contribute more. They're fixed whether the investment returns are positive or negative. So
I'm trying to understand the timing of your compensation increase, because if it had an impact on the 1 year, which, you know, you now have an unfunded liability, that was part of why that liability came in, is the compensation that's been set for the employees for the upcoming a greater percentage increase than what's assumed in the report?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, yes. The short answer to that is yes. So I believe the police pay plan has roughly 4.25% increments between steps. And if you look at the report, what is their assumption? And this is another, you know, one of these big assumptions that they make in the report, again, that impact the calculations. They're assuming they keep dialing it down. It used to be initially, several years back, it was 3.5%. So they assume that employee raises the total employee contribution would increase by 3.5%. Why is that an important factor? Well, because it impacts how many, what the contributions are into the plan, but it also impacts the potential liability. So it kind of has a dual impact there. You know, if you're exceeding, and that, now I'll take a step back. So it was at 3.5%. They've been dialing that back in 0.5% increments year over year to get down to now, I believe in the current report, it's at 2%. So they've had, they went from 3.5 to 3, 3 to 2.5, 2.5 now to 2. So they've had three years in a row now where they've dialed that down. You know, and where that's having an impact, the contributions to the plan pretty much are what they are in terms of they make the estimate, they make the calculation, and then that's what the employer contributes. So from that standpoint, they pretty much are what they are, unless obviously the employer decides to contribute extra. But that liability is the thing that really can fluctuate. It's really kind of a lever. It has kind of almost a compounding impact on the liability because they're assuming that your growth is going to be 2%. Your liability growth is going to be 2%. It's 4.25 or whatever it turns out to be, and then that. That's impacting why it's compounding is because it's impacting your average rate of pay which is obviously that primary factor. It's your years of service plus average year rate of pay. And so if your average rate of pay is growing pretty significantly, especially for your longer tenured employees, then that's really driving significant additional liability growth in the plan. I hope that makes sense. So, they're not going to assume additional investment income return because that is fixed at 7.2% now. So it has to come out of contributions. There's really no other place for that to be funded by.
So, David, I know there's tools out there where you can actually look at the future, what the impact is to the employer. And I don't know if Oral Valley uses that, but have you thought of using it? Because it seems to me if your growth and compensation is more than the assumption, even putting more dollars in, you're still going to have an unfunded liability, particularly if investment earnings go down.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, absolutely. There is a tool actually created by Foster & Foster, who's the actuarial consultants. So they developed this report. They've actually worked hand-in-hand with the plan, with PSPRS, to develop an Excel worksheet that you can actually input different factors and assumptions and kind of model out what those changes are and the impact that they have on your assets and liabilities moving forward. So we have access to that, and we certainly can model that, model those changes. Additionally, at this body, at the BFC, I believe it was prior to me, but we've actually brought that tool to the BFC and actually taken a look at different scenarios as to what that kind of looks like moving forward. So that is certainly something that we can do at the next meeting, bring it back, maybe have kind of a study, more or less a study session where we can take a look at the tool and run through some of those different key assumptions that are impacting the model and try to model out what this looks like moving forward.
I think that would be helpful because I do think that you are going to have impacts and you are going to go up and down a little bit, and then that'll depend on how much the town is going to have to outlay depending on your policy. If you're modeling it, I mean that would help. But what was I thinking before that? It'll come to me. I guess what I'm concerned about is if you're setting your policy to continually input more money into it and you're not actually making any headway, is that the best value for the money?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, I think as long as investment yields exceed what the town earns in its normal investment portfolio, which pretty much almost always ought to be the case because our current portfolio has to be so conservative due to Arizona revised statute, and the plan can take on additional risk and invest in assets like equities that the town is just simply precluded from investing in. So their returns and yields ought to pretty much almost always exceed, not always, but almost always, unless it's a very poor, a strange year, a poor earnings year for equities, almost always ought to exceed what the town can earn. I would say that it does make sense to put the money in the plan, in the custody of the plan, because it's going to simply earn more rather than keep it within the town and have it earn less. There are other options out there. We've taken a look at some of those options, a Section 115 trust, et cetera, where we can, which would allow the town to have a wider band of investment options. I think that's for the size of the town and whatever, I think that's extremely risky. And even with that, you'd have to be betting that the town could outperform what the PSPRS plan performance is, which in some years that may be the case, in other years it may not. And so I just think that's, to me, the question is always, it comes back to why you would want to assume risk like that, where you're basically betting that you're going to outperform this large plan with a much larger asset base. And you know, it's going to be naturally going to be more diversified. So I think you'd be taking on more risk that wouldn't necessarily play out in your favor in the long run. So it could, but I hope that addresses your comment.
It does in a way, but I wasn't thinking so much as a town holding on to the money and investing in it. I was thinking of using the money for the community, for other items. It's more what I was thinking.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, I think that's a valid point, and that's something that council would need to consider, you know, would want to consider. There are going to be needs moving forward, and I know this is certainly an area that it looks like there's a lot of money that's being dedicated and has been obligated towards this purpose, and that's I don't know that can be debated. I think it's been a good move. I think that to me the question comes back to, okay, what is the goal here ultimately, and we have a goal that's established in policy that says by 2036 we're going to be 100% funded, and that's a worthy goal. The question is, well, if you're not 100% funded before then, is that a problem? And I think this goes back to, I think it was a much larger problem when we were 50% funded or 46% funded as we were in the court plan. I mean, that's a problem. However, if we're 95% funded or 98% funded or 100% funded, 100% is great. That ought to be the target, but what happens if you don't quite meet the target, like we drop down to 95? Historically, I mean, when you look at defined benefit plans, 80% funded has always been considered healthy. And if you look at ASRS, it's not quite 80%. I believe it's 75, 76% funded, if I remember correctly. So I don't know that because we're not 100% funded as of June, that's just a date, it's just a data point in time. It was great when we were 102. I don't think the world is falling that we're 95. We're going to contribute an additional $2.5 million this year. We're going to be hopefully close to 98, if not above. And we'll see where the actuaries, take us next fiscal year. But I think there are other needs, and I think that needs to be some sort of balance here, moving forward. But it all comes down to priority at the end of the day. What are the priorities of the community, and that's council's directive to try to make that clear to staff so that we can execute that.
Isn't in the draft policy that you reduce the $2.5 million down to $2 million?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, we were looking at that as part of the draft. We were going to include a draft before you this evening, but felt like that was a little bit premature because there was so much foundation building that needed to occur. But that was part of it because if you look at the overall contributions, we go from 11% to 16%. That naturally is increasing our total contributions by roughly $300,000. So if we were at 11 plus 2.5, we go to 16 plus 2, roughly our total contributions, we save about $100,000 or $200,000, but roughly on par with what we're contributing currently in the current fiscal year. So,
okay. Has there been any discussion or issues with the fact that, we're paying million plus on debt service on the liability
plus we're paying another $2.5 million in addition. Has there been any discussions on that, as people are getting, they don't want to see that, or any?
Mr. Chairman, as a commission, I have not heard anything to that with respect to that. These funds are budgeted. We have a balanced budget, structurally balanced. We have a good surplus. Our general fund is healthy. I have not heard any sort of concern from that.
All right. So, David, in Oral Valley, when you pay every payroll to PSPRS, are you taking the rate times the amount the employee makes? So you're not paying exactly what you budgeted, right?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Garland, that's correct.
Okay. So that's an option. You can always pay what you budgeted, and then you're at least putting more into that. And the other option is in the actuary report, they also have a dollar amount rather than just a percentage. And that will usually put more into the plan, too.
Sure. Mr. Chair Mason, Commissioner Garland, that's correct. Yes. That is also an option.
Any other questions?
Well, I'll just add one more thing, Mr. Chair, because I think it's important to note here. I know that there's the intent with us bringing it up to 100% funding was to achieve future savings. And I think it's important for me to note, because you don't see those savings initially in terms of the budgetary savings. But had we not taken the step, had council not taken the step that they did to issue the pension obligation bonds, to make the funding of additional $10 million, we would be in a much, be having a much different conversation. And our financial status and standing with respect to the funding of this plan would be significantly worse than it currently stands. So I don't want to leave this on a negative note. I want to leave it more on a positive note that things are not as bad. Yes, it's a little bit of a downer. You're at 102 and you go down to 95. That feels kind of bad, especially given some of the steps that we've taken. With that said, had we not taken those steps, our liability would be so much worse than it currently stands. We would not have that type of growth in our asset base, which means our percentage, our employer percentage, would be significantly higher than the 11% or even the 16% that's proposed. It would be massively higher. So, and we could model that out and obviously look at that as well and say, well, if we hadn't done this, then this is where we'd be. But with that said, I think it's important to note that, that we are just in a much stronger position to be able to deal with this and to keep up on it than we've ever been from a financial standpoint. So.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Sit down for a while. next, we have Mayor Winfield.
Thank you, Chair Mason, Commission members. Happy to provide a brief report this evening. This past Friday, the Council had a study session. This is something that we do annually. It focuses on the town's strategic plan, or the Council and staff strategic plan. That was a little atypical from our previous study sessions regarding strategic plan. It was less of an overview of where we're at. We focused on a number of different topics where staff was looking for some direction, or it was more information and discussion, but it was a wide range of topics. Those included the future use of Rooney Ranch, a discussion about RTA Next and contingencies for possible failures of that referendum, some discussion about retail tourism, build-out analysis, which was part of your discussion, I believe, at the last Budget and Finance Commission meeting, some of staff, a few council members and commission members of the Water Utility Commission attended a Growing Water Smart workshop in Paradise Valley several weeks ago. We reported out on that and had about a 45-minute discussion about water management in the town of Oral Valley. We also reviewed a housing study and had a brief discussion on annexation strategies. Tomorrow evening, we have a council meeting that's planned. There's a number of presentations that will include recognizing outgoing boards and commission members. We'll also have the, I don't know if Wendy's back tomorrow evening, probably not, but Dave will be providing a similar report of the quarterly financials. Kristen Sharp, who's the president of the Oro Valley Chamber of Commerce, which the town is a partner with, will be making a presentation. And then Renee, who presented, gave you an update this evening on OV Path Forward, will also give that same presentation to council. We don't have any regular items, but we will have a study session where we will be reviewing the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy, which was approved probably 4 or 5 years ago. So staff is providing an update, suggesting some adjustments to that strategy. And so that will be the bulk of our discussion tomorrow evening. So that's my report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Are there any other questions, or do I have a motion for adjournment?
So
moved. Do I have a second? Okay, we have a motion to adjourn from Commissioner LeMay and a second from Commissioner Miller. And so we're adjourned at 5:50 p.m. Thank you.